Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
CrowdSec, the collaborative and open source cybersecurity solution. Analyze behaviors, respond to attacks, and share signals across the community for free. Let's make the internet safer together. Learn more at crowdsec.net.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Tech Done Different. As always, I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me today is our special guest, Lauren Zabrick, the Executive Director of the Cyber Project at the Belford Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. I hope I got all the parts of the title right.
Yeah, that was great.
Welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you here. I think the work you're doing is pretty awesome.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely talk about some of the work that you guys are doing there at Harvard, but I wanted to start by talking about or asking you about an aspect of your journey. You know, when you and I were talking the other day, it sounded like your path into the security realm was one that wasn't immediately oriented around security, and that sort of was an adaptation, I guess, that came later. And I'm always really interested in those kinds of stories because I think there's this misconception that, you know, in security, if you haven't been hacking a computer since you were four, there's not a place for you. And you're clearly an example of that. I mean, the case. So maybe you could, for the benefit of our audience, kind of talk people through that part of your journey. Like, how did you get into security?
Yeah, absolutely. I also like to use my story as an example of that. I like to say in college, I remember taking a computer science class and I almost failed it. So, you know, no one's more shocked as me than for me to be here. But, you know, while my career really hasn't centered around cybersecurity, at least from an early standpoint, it's always been around national security. And so I started my career in the military as an intelligence officer in the Air Force. And, you know, from there, I later went into a civilian intelligence analyst role where I did counterterrorism work and deployed a bunch of times overseas. And, you know, I really did love that. What happened was in late 2015, early 2016, I left government and somewhat unwillingly, my husband got a job up in Boston. And I tried to get what is called the joint duty assignment with the FBI up here, but it just didn't work out. And so what I thought was going to be sort of the most devastating thing was actually really one of the best things that could have happened. I happened to find this cybersecurity startup called Recorded Future. It was a small startup, you know, way back then. And, you know, I like to say the person who hired me and the CEO really took a chance on me. But I think what they saw in me was that I was an analyst. And so, you know, I think they were hoping and also saw that I could pick up the material very quickly. So I started out as a solutions engineer. So I would go with the salespeople to demo the software. So I literally started out just like basics, right? You know, and there were times where I didn't really know what I was doing. And, you know, people in those sales calls would talk about things like APT 29 and, you know, certain CVEs and certain malware. And I really worked hard to understand that. You know, what were those things that they're talking about? What were the, you know, the advanced persistent threats? What was malware? What were the different vulnerabilities? So I really worked hard in that. And, you know, after about a year, I transitioned to the post-sale side, customer success, where I really took my experience in the federal government and I built up the public sector practice. And so during that time, I became very interested in cyber policy because I really looked around at the landscape. And again, this was 2016 timeframe, and I kind of looked around and said, and because I was so new to this world, I thought, well, this is interesting. Some things seem to work okay, but you know, I think there are things that we could probably do better as a country. And so I became very interested in the policy aspect of cyber. And so, you know, I had deferred a year, but finally entered into the Harvard Kennedy School for my Master's of Public Administration. And I took that desire to really want to explore cyber policy to that. And, you know, I was in Eric Rosenbach's class, the cyber policy class. And, you know, I was that nerd in the front row, just constantly raising their hand and, oh, yeah. You know, call on me. But, you know, I think he saw within me the desire to do something like this and the drive, really. And so when it came time to talk about, you know, jobs after graduation, he, you know, asked me if I would like to take this role because Michael Solmeyer, my predecessor, had gone on to Cybercom. And if you know that name, he is now on the National Security Council as the, I think, senior director of cyber.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So you, in your estimation, what is the relationship between national security and cybersecurity?
I like to say that cybersecurity is national security. But with the caveat that, you know, in this case, the government can't, you know, just protect us all. It's just such a fundamentally different construct than I think what we're used to from a traditional defense and, you know, military paradigm. So, you know, but from a national security standpoint, because the cyber domain offers adversaries from nation states, you know, down to, you know, even criminals alike, you know, it offers them a capability, you know, and offers them reach and, you know, the ability to have an impact and have effect without having to put boots on the ground. And, you know, as we've seen, there's so many, you know, there's a lot of critical infrastructure sectors, for instance, but that's all, you know, in our domestic system. And most of those critical infrastructure entities are really run in the private sector. So, you know, and the military and the intelligence community who are, you know, normally tasked with our defense can't operate in those spaces. And the adversary knows that. And so they seek to exploit, you know, those particular aspects of our system. And you know, they've done quite well, you know, when you look at things like their wins and, you know, the Microsoft Exchange server issue and just all of these operations that we've seen. I think more and more, you know, adversaries are, you know, really looking at how they can exploit that, you know, our, you know, different states and all the different companies and our supply chains. It's like, you know, we're pretty vulnerable. So I think it offers a very attractive target for those actors.
So if I was to hand you a magic wand, and with that magic wand, anything could happen to address this problem, what would the magic wand do? Like, putting aside the impracticalities of why it might be difficult to solve the problem, what needs to happen?
A lot of things need to happen, I think, across the board. Some of the things that we've looked at are, you know, if we look at the international space, for instance, and that's been an area, I think, of study for, you know, many organizations for the last couple of years, but, you know, still we're at a place where there's just not a lot of rules in this domain. So certainly more rules and norms there. And, you know, in an upcoming paper, we argue that, you know, the SolarWinds incident and other operations that, you know, may come to light really offer us, I think, the opportunity to finally sort of declare what we think is appropriate and not appropriate in cyberspace and, you know, get more of our like-minded allies and partners, things to sort of sign on to that. So, you know, that's in the international realm. You know, things like supply chain security, you know, how can we increase the resilience of our many different supply chains? you know, and that's something that we're working on with, I'm part of the R Street Institute Secure and Competitive Markets Initiative. So we're looking at different aspects of the supply chain and the security or the strategy around that. And then something like, you know, I think a lot of people in this space, you know, have been especially recently talking about cyber defense, because it's clear that, you know, there are elements of our offensive strategy that, I mean, how can, you know, just a relatively small group, I think, of, you know, professionals, very good professionals, you know, defend against all of the threats? You know, we can't, again, because, you know, of operating in quote unquote blue spaces. So how can we then increase our defensive posture? And that's another thing that we've been looking at the cyber project for, gosh, probably about a year and a half now. And, you know, we've done a number of interviews and a lot of research, and we're writing this paper and just trying to make it, you know, as good as we can. But, you know, it's an idea, essentially a couple of ideas on how we can move towards a more collaborative defensive environment across the nation, and improve the nature of our threat intelligence sharing across different entities. And then other things, you know, emerging technologies and data and, you know, just looking at various aspects of that. So there's so many different pieces to it. And then of course with diversity. So I'm a co-founder of the movement called Share the Mic in Cyber. And that is really predicated on the notion that diversity is national security, and diversity in cybersecurity is extremely important for a number of reasons, but, you know, chiefly to be able to identify and analyze threats that maybe aren't threats to a certain sect of the population, but do impact others, and to be able to see that and to be able to mitigate those threats. So the challenges are multifaceted, but yes, but certainly no shortage of work to be found.
So tell me about this idea. I've not heard it phrased that way before, and I find that really intriguing, this idea that diversity is national security. Tell me what you mean by that.
So, yeah, great question. And, you know, I'll say that my co-founder in this movement of Share the Mic in Cyber, Camille Stewart, she, you know, says this just so well. But, you know, it takes the best and the brightest, and it takes our very diverse human capital to meet the threat, to meet the national security threat, the ever-growing, the ever-diversifying threat that we face, you know, in this country. And, you know, I've heard people say this before, but, you know, our adversaries don't discriminate. So why should we, you know, if, you know, we have just all these different kinds of, you know, problems that we're facing, shouldn't we therefore put forth, you know, people who can address these challenges in a multitude of ways, you know, like almost like a layered defense sort of thing. You know, if we have people who are good at X and people good at Y and people good at Z, shouldn't we put those people forth? Shouldn't we be able to, you know, help defend our nation with everyone we have to bear? You know, it takes the, you know, our human capital. And, you know, that involves, I believe, safety and security, you know, economic security, health security, et cetera, you know, for our people in order to do this. I mean, a sick and unhealthy population can't meet the threat to our national security as well as we need.
Man, it's amazing. I asked you a question about an idea that I hadn't heard before, and your answer revealed it in yet another idea, which I'm so fascinated by. And this idea of describing diversity as analogous to defense in depth. That's such a cool idea. Can you expand upon what your thinking is in that idea? That's awesome.
Oh, thank you. I think that was probably not necessarily intentional, but yeah,
let's go with it then.
Yeah, let's go with it. You know, if you have someone who, you know, if we just want to look at cybersecurity, for instance, you know, take someone like me, I'm in cyber policy. I don't know how to do vulnerability assessment or pen testing or things like that. But there are plenty of, you know, people who do. So to me, it's like, it's comparative advantage. It's competitive advantage, for instance, to get the people who want to do these things, who know how to do these things, who are good at doing things, to do them, you know, to bring those capabilities to the challenge. And if we don't get more people, and if we don't get people with different perspectives, then we're not going to understand those threats. And so, yeah, from a defense, you know, or defense in depth standpoint, there's just so many different aspects, I think, to, you know, to meet that challenge.
I like it. So can you elaborate on the, I guess there's two parts to this question. This might be a big answer to a question, so answer whichever part of it you want to succinctly, but what's the mission of the center that you run there at Harvard, and what is the work that you guys are focusing on right now? I mean, I'm reading that it's, you know, relating national security as a, you know, cybersecurity is a national security issue, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
So at the Belfer Center, it's, you know, the full name is the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. And its whole premise is, you know, ideas for a more, you know, peaceful future, basically. And so there's all these different projects and programs within the center. So for instance, you have something like the Cyber Project. You also have the Future of Diplomacy Project. You have the Middle East Institute. You have the project on, you know, managing the atom. And that's just four of the projects there. And so, you know, we are very focused on, you know, impactful, actionable policy research. So, you know, things that we can hopefully present to not only the public, but to policymakers and, you know, people in academia, et cetera, to push forth these ideas, you know, in order to continue to secure not only our nation, but also, you know, our values abroad with our allies and, you know, in competition with adversaries as well.
And what do you think is the primary, maybe there's more than one, but if you had to pick one, what's the primary obstacle in the way of that brighter future you guys are working towards?
That's a good question. I think there's a number of obstacles. You know, certainly politics and different ideas and different visions for, you know, how to get things done or even whether to get things done. But, you know, I think now with the current administration, there's obviously more of an appetite in these spaces to be more forward leaning and, you know, push forth some of these ideas, which is great. But I think too, you know, just looking around the world and seeing, all the different challenges that we face, I mean, you know, it's, these challenges are multifaceted, from, you know, economic issues to public health issues to security issues. And it's not just a black and white thing. So, I heard someone the other day talk about how public policy is a way to engineer, you know, public behavior or human behavior to get people to do the right thing. And so, you know, I loved that. I thought that was great. And I think he's right. But there are, I think, different ideas of what the right thing is, you know, across the world. And I think there are just different desires, I guess, and not only desires, but abilities to do the right thing as well. So it's just so multifaceted, all the different challenges.
Man, you just keep dropping golden nuggets on me all day today. So now what I just heard you say was that public policy is essentially social engineering, right? It's a technique to influence behavior.
I mean, I guess you could say that. I certainly didn't intend it that way. It's just but I see what you're saying, and I don't want to cast it in a negative light.
Social engineering is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah. I think in the security, the cybersecurity world, we've been trained that it's not a good thing. And so I don't want to conflate it with the negative, interpretation of that. But yeah, I think it's an important question. Like, how do you get people to do the right thing? And what is the right thing, you know, at that time? And I think that question, you know, it's a really challenging one.
So inherent in this idea, the right thing, you know, if we put that in air quotes, of course, denotes ethics, denotes a common agreed upon set of norms and beliefs, et cetera. To what extent is a discussion of ethics important and relevant to the discussion that you're talking about? Like, is the right thing inherently obvious to everybody or not?
I wish it was. Yeah. You know. I want to tread lightly here because I don't purport to have all the answers. Sure. And I think of myself as an ethical and moral person. But I don't want to say that I, you know, can cast judgment on, you know, other people, because I know that there are different circumstances, you know, whether it's sort of economic ability and, you know, just all these other human challenges. So I want to sort of stay away from more of like that ethical, sure, discussion, at least here.
Yeah, no, I don't have the answers either. I'm just always curious. I get those questions a lot. I mean, like in the profession of ethical hacking, the first word, yeah, you know, people are always like, well, let's talk about ethics. And so I certainly agreed. I mean, I feel like even people who are the, you know, undisputed thought leaders in ethics struggle with this topic too. So yeah, no need for you to feel like you have to be that person.
I'm not an ethicist, and I know there's a whole, you know, just discipline of study around that. And I really have no experience in that. I try to do the right thing.
Yeah, so, I hear you. Very cool. So when you're working on this paper right now, that's coming out soon, when you guys are investing your time, effort, money, energy into writing a paper like this, what is the desired outcome once the paper is done?
It's a great question. You know, once a paper is done, you know, again, where our whole aim is to have impact, you know, we intend to get it out to the widest audience possible. But not only that, but to also a very targeted audience. And so the hope is that you get it in front of someone who not only cares about the subject, but could also potentially do something about it. So whether that's, you know, in the legislative branch, in the executive branch, for instance, if you know, you're looking to that level, maybe it's state government, maybe it's industry, that sort of thing. And so it certainly depends on the audience, but, you know, I think our primary audience is definitely in the federal government. And, you know, from there, hopefully, you know, you get in front of people, like I said, and obviously in this pandemic and, you know, in a virtual environment, you know, hopefully you can have even wider reach. But, you know, typically we might do events around, you know, that paper and do sort of a media push, maybe spin off some op-eds. So different ways to get to a customer where they can actually digest that information, because obviously not everyone has the ability to, you know, read through a 20, 30, 40, you know, page paper.
One of the things that I have observed, and I've seen a lot of other security professionals talk about at great length as well, is that security is really a leadership challenge, as much as it is it's a technical problem, no doubt, but it is dead in the water if it's not supported and pursued by leadership. So in the context of the federal government, if we're talking about security is a leadership challenge, and then you talk about the top level of leadership, you know, all the way up to the White House, but then you're at a level that's so far abstracted from the actual profession of security. How should we be thinking about what the responsibility is at, say, at the White House level, like in terms of driving what happens in terms of cybersecurity as a national security issue?
Yeah, you know, I think to your point, from the very top, setting those priorities. And I think we've seen, you know, this new administration do that. And also too, you know, within the legislative branch. So, you know, we saw the Cyber Solarium emission report, for instance, come out last year. And a lot of those legislative recommendations have come, you know, out through the NDAA last year, for instance. And then I know that, you know, the executive branch is operationalizing, you know, a number of them. So for instance, with the new national cyber director, for instance, so trying to stand up that office and not only just trying to operationalize some of those recommendations, but also selecting the right people for those jobs. So you have Chris Inglis, for instance, as the nominee for that job, if he hasn't already been confirmed. You have Jen Easterly as the nominee for the CISA director role. And then you have Ann Neuberger, you know, as the cyber person on the NSC. So you have people who are very experienced in this and, you know, have this desire to, you know, to continue to serve, but also to, you know, to improve things basically. And that's why I think, you know, people do get into public policies to help, you know, improve policies for our nation. So prioritizing those sorts of things, you know, looking at, you know, installing people who care about and understand these, you know, new emerging tech challenges, for instance. For instance, you know, Wendy Sherman at the State Department, you know, very interested in, you know, cyber and tech diplomacy, for instance. I'm sure Mayorkas is as well. Actually, no, he's DHS, I'm sorry. I don't know who scotched that. But you know, again, setting those priorities from the top and then putting in leaders who share those responsibilities and those desires, and then promulgating those down and getting people in who have those ideas and have the desire to, you know, put the work in to make those changes. And not only that, but I think who have, you know, contacts within industry and academia and that sort of thing. So you can bring, you know, more of a whole of nation response to these issues as well.
Awesome. So from your viewpoint, how do we measure success in security?
Gosh, I haven't been asked that question. Because I don't necessarily think we don't see, you know, a certain number of operations, because I think we're not going to see certain things, you know, especially where, you know, the cyber domain does offer a level of, you know, cover, at least for a little while. You know, if you look at SolarWinds, they weren't discovered until, you know, an employee at FireEye inadvertently, you know, kind of took the lid off of that. So I think that there are other metrics or other standards by which you can judge that by. And so, and I do think, you know, the number of, you know, quote unquote, cyber attacks potentially decreasing, especially the ones that are a little bit more noisy. But I think the answer too has to be our own resilience. So building up our defenses, building up our resilience, taking measures to do that, you know, across the board. And I think that's everything from, you know, different companies and different, you know, and states and, you know, sort of, you know, their levels of resilience, but even on the way down to an individual. And, you know, I hate the term cyber hygiene, but, you know, when you have an average person who knows some very simple things that they can do to, you know, raise their own level of security, and then therefore I think that raises it even higher. And then our collective security even higher. And then even, you know, say companies who maybe haven't taken cybersecurity as a priority in the past, you know, for a number of different reasons, perhaps resources and time and just not fully understanding it. But I think seeing those companies, you know, take that responsibility and take it more seriously. And so I think, you know, kind of small things, just raising the level of their own security to raise, you know, the level of our collective security.
I love it. Well, as we come to a close here and wrap up our time together, what would be any parting wisdom or last words that you want to leave with our audience here today?
Gosh, that's a very, very broad question.
Yeah. What action should we take?
You know, I think going back to what we were just talking about is everyone taking their own personal security more seriously and you know, at the company level too. And I'm not talking about, you know, these big companies that have cybersecurity, you know, offices and things like that, that's already happening, but, you know, smaller companies and individuals. I think there are some very simple things that we can do. And so understanding that, trying to bake security into certain practices, I think from that standpoint, that would, I think, significantly raise the level of security across the board. Yeah, that's what I would say for what we can do. I think that would be really helpful. You know, and I worry too that cybersecurity, personal security is sort of becoming like a digital commons issue, where you know, before people may not have, you know, understood the problem, understood the threat, understood how they can do it. But I worry, and I don't have any evidence of this, but I just worry, are people starting to understand more, but maybe they're just not caring. I don't know. So I'd love to see more of that education and more of that call to action, I guess you can say, and understanding like what happens to your data and, you know, how to use a password manager and things like that. So I think there's a lot we can do, and I think we can start doing it from, you know, a young age.
Powerful stuff. I love it. Lauren, thank you so much for being on the show. You've given me a lot to think about and hopefully our audience as well. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ted. I really appreciate being here, and it was a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Yeah, same for me. All right, everybody, if you want to learn more about what Lauren's up to or to request to appear on the show yourself, just head over to tedharrington.com/podcast, and we will catch you next time.
CrowdSec, the collaborative and open source cybersecurity solution. Analyze behaviors, respond to attacks, and share signals across the community for free. Let's make the internet safer together. Learn more at crowdsec.net.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.